December 30th, 1982, and I'm talking to Burton Biss at his home in Wasilla. Do you want to just give me some early background information on where you were born and where you did your early schooling?
Let's see, I was born in Cato, New York, which is a... actually, I was born near Cato, New York, on a farm, dairy farm, dairy and produce, which is upstate New York, Drumlin section, Finger Lake section,
mm-hmm.
About 25-30 miles south of Lake Ontario, in the lake country, fruit country. Went to school, of course, to high school there, and I then went in the Naval Air Corps. Upon graduation from school when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been 1945. And I was an aviation cadet, flying midshipman. And let's see. After I got out of service, I went to Cornell and got my undergrad there in 1949 and Cornell Law 52.
Why did you decide to go to law school?
I still had some GI Bill eligibility and I didn't have anything else to do.
Were there any lawyers in your family or anything like that?
No, I didn't even know an attorney.
Yeah.
By any name.
So it was just...
I can remember being startled at my first attendance at a class that was entitled Bills and Notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any concept of what they were talking about, bills and notes. Notes were something that you wrote, you know, to people. I didn't, it took me a little while to catch on what they were talking about.
What made you come to Alaska?
Basically, I was interested in less developed country and hunting and fishing.
Uh-huh.
You know? Which was always a family hobby on the farm. I had 4 brothers and 6 sisters, and my father and my uncles and everyone had always, they had always been hunting and fishing as a act of recreation. And I thought it would be nice to try it in Alaska.
Did any of your brothers and sisters come to Alaska?
No one else has come to Alaska to live. They've all visited up here over the years, but none of them have come here to live.
Mm-hmm. Have any of them become lawyers?
No. None of them have become lawyers. We're probably very, very top-heavy in teachers and doctors, medical doctors and the teaching profession.
How many of each?
Oh, golly. I couldn't give you a count, including, you know, nephews and nieces.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, I guess there's about 3 medical doctors in the nephew and niece class and probably 15-20 teachers. There's everybody went into teaching school. Several of them are in administration, and some of my sisters, of course, are old enough, so they're now retired teachers.
Mm-hmm. Where are you in the family, as far as age range?
I'm next to the youngest.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
When you came to, why did you come to Alaska? I mean, you came because of the hunting and fishing.
Well, I was employed right out of law school. I didn't, I walked out of the last exam with my bags packed and got on the airplane.
Uh-huh. Had you ever any intention to stay in New York, in upstate New York? Or?
No, I never, I kind of do things as they come along. I didn't intend to return to New York. I intended to stay here. And I did. Took the bar here and remained. I came up clerking for United States District Court Judge George W. Folta back in the territorial court system. Mm-hmm. He'd had a clerk at Murdy's ahead of me, and Murdy's went into, he was going into the prosecuting attorney's office. And so when the vacancy came up, I believe Judge Folta asked him to look for somebody else, because this was not something that the judge was particularly interested in doing. Mm-hmm. And so I believe he contacted Cornell. The placement professor there was Ernest Warren. And Ernie Warren got a hold of me and asked me if I'd be interested, and I said yes. I had interviewed, for probably one of the most decisive things about coming to Alaska was that I had interviewed down on Wall Street, you're sent down, a certain percentage of your class goes down in interviews on Wall and goes through the firms down there. And I had, three different places where I could go down on Wall Street, because apparently I had good references or something from the professor. But I wasn't ever particularly enamored of New York City. Mm-hmm. And Ernie Warren, the placement professor, was from upstate and had practiced upstate before he went into teaching. And he told me that when he was graduated from law school, he had a chance to go into one of the large firms down in New York City. But he said he was married at the time, and he had this little dog, and he wouldn't ask the dog to live in that city. And I kind of agreed with him. As a matter of fact, I had lunch with one of the senior partners in, I can't remember what firm it was, and he suggested that in the long run, in the long life, he wished that he had stayed out in the country and not gone to the city, and I thought that that was probably good advice. Mm-hmm. It's a different life, and I would prefer it.
What was Juno like with Judge Folta?
Oh, let's see, when it came to Juno, it flew up in one of the old, Douglas tail dragger type airplanes. They weren't pressurized cabins. Mm-hmm. When it took off in Seattle, I know they loaded a lot of freight into the airplane. It was a regular scheduled passenger plane, but it wasn't as sophisticated as you have now. And so apparently they had a little trouble with room for freight and passengers too, because I know I was seated in front of the aircraft and they fitted a crate of young baby chicks on the floor, so I sat with my feet on top of those. Mm-hmm. And of course they peeped like baby chicks will until we got to altitude, and then they all die. It's automatic. I don't know why they ever put them on the airplane, but they all die whenever you get an unpressurized cabin. Nowadays, all your air freight is protected. But anyway, there was no more peeping when we got to the Juno.
Why did they put the chicks on to begin with if they knew they were going to die?
The only thing that I can say is that although it would be certainly common knowledge with some people, apparently you can always order something and somebody will send you, a bikini if you're living at the North Pole. There's no problems with that part.
As long as you pay the bill.
The commercial aspects of it override the practicality, and that's apparently, there was no other way to get baby chicks to Alaska, see, because they're only born with enough sustenance within their system to last them about 2.5-3 days without food or water. Mm-hmm. And so air transportation is the only practical way, directly from the hatchery. Some of them will survive longer than that, but they won't survive high altitude. Anyway, you couldn't send them up by boats, you see.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But at that time, there was still some agriculture in Juneau. There was this Mendenhall Dairy was in operation. There were cows around. You could get fresh milk. Mm-hmm. And it was a much more fishing-oriented rural community. It wasn't so overwhelmed by government as it was later. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that time, the legislature met every other year, which is a wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm. Did you go hunting with Judge Folker? He was a big bear hunter.
I went hunting with him, not really hunting. You see, you had to be here a year before you could get a resident license, mm-hmm. and a non-resident license was economically not a feasible mm-hmm. thing until I'd been here a year. So I went out with him several times as a cook and packed gear and so forth, you know, and just enjoyed the countryside, which is as much as you can get out of hunting anyway. Mm-hmm. And he had trails all over the southeast, his mm-hmm. own personal, private trails. Mm-hmm. He would take off, we'd go out, say, to Yankee Basin outside of Juneau. I'd drive out to the end of the road, catch a good sunny afternoon in the spring when the bear would be coming out. And we'd drive out there and park the car and hike off on one of the old, I guess the CCC originally made those trails. Mm-hmm. And you take off up on the trail, and then after you'd gone a certain distance, judge would stop and plow through the brush for ways, and then would start his trail, which he had machetes cached around. You know, that's very thick country in some places. And it would be his own private trail nobody else knew about. Mm-hmm. And he knew how to get across the various rivers without using the bridges, and where the fords were, and what time of day the water would be at the right level to ford a glacial stream, and where the bogs were, and many areas, you know, where there'd been storms come through with windfalls. His trail would be off the ground, walking trunks. Mm-hmm. And it would go to a particular vantage point where you'd have a view of a slope or a series of bars in a river valley or something, mm-hmm. And where bear would appear. Various hunters are interested in different animals, and they have a kind of a relationship with the different animals. Some people, you know, hunt foxes. Judge Fuller hunted bears. And I guess he was probably the last of the great bear hunters as such. So he, if there was a bear in the countryside, he knew where to find him, and he knew what he would do and where. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting. He had very definite techniques on hunting.
Mm-hmm. What did he do with that? He
would dress out the bear, you know, skin him, usually there was always a ready market for bear skins. He gave them away to friends. Mm-hmm. He loved to hunt them, mm-hmm. And he liked to hunt them really in southeastern, that type of hunting. He had hunted out the peninsula and up here where in the terrain hunting out the Alaska Peninsula, mm-hmm. you can see a bear at a long distance, mm-hmm. Very often. And although you're getting to alders in some sections, you can see a bear from his toenails up when he's trotting along sandbars. Mm-hmm. That wasn't really appealing hunting to him. He liked to hunt them in the thick, heavy brush in southeast, crawling along through the brush, along stem and stream. encountering and shooting his bear at 30 feet, you know, or less. Mm-hmm. He got right up very, very close.
Is it more sporting, did he think?
It's more sporting, I suppose, from the bear's point of view.
Yeah. No.
But then the bear wasn't voluntarily engaging in sport anyway, but it gives for a much more exciting type of operation. I can remember one of the FBI fellows, maybe it was Tim Casey, maybe it was the sidekick Bob, went hunting with Judge Fulda. Anyway, when he came back, he was still shaking his head because blood splattered on him when the judge shot the bear.
Oh.
They were close.
Oh. How close were you when you were hunting with him?
Oh. He was you know, nowadays, with a different series of attitudes and conceptions and so forth, many old hunters are criticized. Mm-hmm. But Judge Fulda was in a different climate in a different niche. He was marvelous, huh? Mm-hmm. Just absolutely, he would have done well, you know, as a white hunter in Africa. Was very perceptive, had wonderful eyesight, farsighted. Just a marvelous field shot off his hind legs under pressure. It was a fine shot. Nowadays, I suppose he'd be criticized because he shot so many bear over so many years. Like they now criticize the old ivory hunters, W.D. and Bell, who killed 1,000 or so elephants. But there was a time when those people were respected and looked up to for their very unique talents and abilities. And he was one of them.
So he held a place in the community?
Oh, yes. Well, see, I think I once saw a book on big game hunting that was written in 1928. Mm-hmm. And in it, they identified an assistant United States attorney in Juneau who was an authority on bear hunting, George W. Fulda. He was the prosecuting attorney at that time.
Did it fit his personality? Is there a personality of a hunter?
In the sense that you know, old hunters get kind of mystical. And yes, many people only saw Judge Fulda sitting on the bench as a very stern and unbending type person, but they had never hunted with him. He was a wonderful company on a hunt.
Yeah.
And really a fine person. He was one of the blue-eyed Presbyterians, you know. As a matter of fact, he once told me about, let's see, I think they were having an election for maybe the elders in the Presbyterian Church in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
And he said there was a couple of, you know, outstanding people in the community, maybe like Dr. Whitehead or somebody. Anyway, there were other names put up, and somebody put his name up too.
Mm-hmm.
And then in order to, he said so that he wouldn't have no votes at all, he voted for himself. And then when it came time to, I guess he must have voted on a ballot. When it came time to count the ballots and announce the winners, they asked the candidates to all stand out in the hall while they did this. And so then he said he could hear roars of laughter inside, and then they came out and asked the candidates to come back in, and he had been elected unanimously, so everybody knew he voted for himself. But that was the type of person he was. He would never imagine that he would he would be winning. He always conceived that he was the lesser person than he was.
He was good friends with Bert Faulkner.
Yes, Bert Faulkner was a fine old gentleman.
Can you tell me a little bit about their friendship and about Bert Faulkner?
I can't tell you much about Bert Faulkner. He was elderly when I first arrived, and I saw him in our library and passed the time of day very casually with him. But Bert was, you know, set the tone for that portion of the bar in the Southeast.
What do you mean?
Well, he was a fine, thorough attorney. Mm-hmm. Anything that came out of Faulkner, Banfield, and Blucher when I was clerking, you can see the quality of performance.
Mm-hmm.
And their work was excellent.
What about Robertson, Montague, and Stowe?
Mm-hmm.
Was it different kinds of work did they do?
It's similar as you do today. You still have divisions. You'll have general practice firms and so forth. Bert, at the time, and let's see, I came here May 28, 1952.
Mm-hmm.
And Bert was, he would appear in court and argue occasionally on motions. I don't think he was doing as much research and briefing anymore because his eyesight was failing very considerably and he was having trouble reading for more than a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But they did, Robertson, Monagle, and Eastall. Of course, Mike Monagle was more into perhaps criminal defense work than the others. But, you know, of the old line established firm type of concept with more stratified classes, Faulkner, Banfield, and Blucher was the Cadillac of the operation.
Then and Robertson, Monagle, and Easter, how did you, where'd you get them?
Oh, they were, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of private practitioners that perhaps didn't do the same quality of work or the same didn't have the same group of clients.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the leading members in the community would be represented by Bert Faulkner. Bert Faulkner.
Mildred Herman was practicing then. Do you remember her?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was she on?
Babe? I think I just saw her once or twice. I don't ever remember being involved in any research on a case in which she was involved.
Mm-hmm.
You would see these people occasionally at a bar luncheon, which I used to attend because I thought it was important to find out who were the members of the bar. I've, over the years, found that that's not so important, so I don't attend anymore.
Did most of the bar attend the lunches?
Yes.
They were there, though.
Mm-hmm.
What'd they do?
Oh, it was perhaps more relaxed type of operation than perhaps bar association luncheons are now. And of course, there are many fewer people, so that everyone, when you sat down to lunch, as in all groups, you know, the certain friends with affinities will be seated together and so forth, and there was much of a social gathering, and the drinkers drank, and the other ones told stories and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to any other group, I don't think it's changed all that much.
Were there other hunters in the bar? Were there other people who went up
hunting?
Hunting?
Oh yes,
fishing?
Sure.
Who were the other ones?
I think probably everybody. Well, not everybody, but a large majority of the adult population, certainly adult males, mm-hmm. Juno, mm-hmm. either hunted or fished. Bob Blucher was a beautiful fly fisherman,
mm-hmm.
he's a trout fisherman. I don't ever recollect him hunting, although undoubtedly, you know, everybody hunted deer and goat
mm-hmm.
down there. But I can remember going fishing. Coming up to Turner Lake, Bob had a riverboat. Maybe he owned it, maybe he borrowed it, I can't remember for sure. But I remember him taking me up to Turner Lake, hiking back into the cabin. Mm-hmm. Forest Service used to maintain boats. You packed your own motor in over the trail. It was nice country. There's wolves howling in the rocks at night. And it's an interesting lake. Much of it has no shoreline, it's just straight cliff. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of streams flowing into it from the snowfields up above, and they just pitch off, you know, a 100-foot cliff. You can put your hand on the shoreline and strip all of your fly line off and all the backing, and you still don't hit bottom. It's a deep lake. Mm-hmm. It has a bog jam that it has it dammed up at the outlet. It's a nice fish.
Did groups go? Did groups of lawyers go out?
Oh, yeah, you know, friends went hunting.
Friends.
Yeah, friends went
hunting. You never got a bunch of lawyers to go out. They never.
Not that I recollect, anyway. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in Juneau all that long. See, I was. Let's see, I clerked for Judge Folda from May 28, 1952, till about the following September, maybe, something like that. Mm-hmm. A year and a half.
Yeah.
September of the following year. Somewhere in there. It's a little over a year, as I recollect. A few months over a year. I'd come to Juneau. You know, before coming up, I'd subscribed to the Juneau newspaper, mm-hmm. which is, you know, give you an idea of what's going on in the community and so forth. So I'd read the Juneau newspaper, and I'd looked up their climate information and basic information in the library, and it indicated that it was very, very rainy. Mm-hmm. But it was raining when I got off the airplane, you know, in May. Mm-hmm. But between then and the 4th of July, it only rained twice.
Oh, okay.
The first time for 32 days, and the second time for about a day and a half.
A mere 32 days. Oh, God.
Anyway.
Did you enjoy Juneau?
Mm-hmm. At that time, it was a much more isolated, insular type community.
Mm-hmm.
Anchorage was upstart, approximately the same size as Juneau. And people came to Anchorage who were only interested in making money rather than living a good life and being decent and upright people, so far as Juneau was. They really did not like Anchorage, even at that time, and I've heard that the feeling hasn't changed much since.
What about Fairbanks?
I didn't get to Fairbanks in the old days up until, let's see. Yeah, I remember going up to Fairbanks on a workman's compensation case. It kind of cured me of doing workman's comp work. Somehow or other, some young fellow had gotten injured on a job, and he couldn't think of the name of his employer. So when he complained, he could remember the people who had formerly employed him a few months before. Mm-hmm. And he put their name down too, as well as the name of somebody had figured out who his actual employer was. And I guess he was working for a subcontractor on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he...
Just doing everybody, right?
He threw in everything he could think of. And so I went up to represent the workman's comp carrier for the previous employer.
Mm-hmm.
since obviously it wasn't anything that required any knowledge or talent. All you had to do was just explain to Henry Benson, who was the commissioner then, that we didn't have anything to do with it. And that's what I did. And the workman was there, and he agreed. He remembered that it was what the circumstances were. So it wasn't much of a case. The startling thing about to me at that time, not realizing how these things are done, is that no one else showed up. The people who were directly involved and should have been there representing them, no one else appeared other than myself and the claimant at the hearing. And he hadn't been paid, and he was rather seriously injured, and he'd gone about 6-7 months, and nobody was paying any attention to him. So Henry Benson looked at me and said, "Well, you're here, so I'm ordering you people to pay." It took us about a year and a half to get that refurbished. I remember going for a walk around town with Henry. It was a nice sunny day in early spring, lots of snowbanks, you know, but it was bright warm sunshine, the water was running around, we were counting the log cabins. Henry liked to get some exercise, and so we walked around town. But that was my recollection of Fairbanks. It didn't have very much that stuck up in the air. It was mostly pretty low log cabins.
You didn't want to stay in Juneau when you were done clerking?
Oh,
or did you?
Didn't make any difference to me. I had Judge Folda. I recollect either Ray Plummer spoke to Judge Folda or Judge Folda spoke to Ray Plummer. Mm-hmm. And they were friends. I don't think they were close friends, but I think Judge Folda had admired Ray Plummer, and I know that he suggested to me that if I wanted to go into private practice, that would be the best place to go, mm-hmm. and that Ray was looking for someone to keep the door open. Ray was going, I think he was in the legislature at the time, I'm sure he was. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I think he was in the legislature down in Juneau at the time I terminated my clerkship with Judge Folda and went over to his office. Mm-hmm. So I went to work for Ray Plummer, never having been in a law office in my life, mm-hmm. never having set my foot inside the door of a law office with myself and a secretary. There was no one else there.
And Ray Plummer was in Juneau in the yes. legislature, and you mm-hmm. were holding down the
floor. I was
oh.
it.
Oh,
I was it. I'd been admitted, for a few months. I forget when I was admitted. Anyway, we took the exam. I was admitted. And went to work in the office. Somebody would come in, you know, with a long tale of woe and all these sad and terrible things had happened to him. You sit down, go through all of this and take a long bunch of notes and stuff, and I felt like telling them, you know, what you should do is go see an attorney. You got troubles. But anyway.
How did you make it through?
Oh, all good things come to an end, you know, and after a couple of 3 months, Ray got back and got things organized. It takes quite a while to forget what you learned in law school, you know, but you can do it.
If you try hard enough.
Yes.
What was the bar exam like?
Bar examination worried the dickens out of me. There was a statute that required certain subjects to be covered. Mm-hmm. I'd read that statute when I was still at Cornell. And so I can remember, see, I think top on the list was Admiralty or something like that. And we had Gustavus Hill Robson at Cornell. And so...
Who is that?
Professor Robison.
And he's the guy who wrote the book on Admiralty?
Yes. And so I went and asked him, since I didn't know anything about Admiralty.
Mm-hmm.
I rowed a boat up and down Seneca River, but that was about as far as I... And anyway, I think he suggested that I look at a handbook or something. And somewhere along the line, he said some words of wisdom about the priority of liens.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember how it came up. Maybe, as a matter of fact, he might have been consulted by somebody, maybe Ed Murdy's or something, in connection with taking the bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I used to be able to memorize things without too much effort, and I memorized the priority of liens in Admiralty. So I took the bar examination. There was the required question. They were required to examine on Admiralty, and they asked for the priority of liens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never knew what the grading results were, but I rather assumed I had that one correct. Other than that, great majority of the bar exam was constitutional law.
Mm-hmm.
I had studied constitutional law under Dr. Robert E. Cushman as an undergrad at Cornell for something like $8, I think. And I'd taken con law from Sutherland at the law school. And so I was fairly well saturated, and when you read a question, you could see the question was written on the basis of what would be the law, say, in 1933. The questions were very, very old.
Yeah.
And you could read the question, you could see what answer they wanted, but on the other hand, that wasn't the law anymore. I had to write furiously throughout the exam, because you had to answer the question and then distinguish it. This is what...
No longer the case.
This is no longer the case since this case and this case. I always have problems remembering cases by their captions. And the rule of law is much easier for me to grasp than it is to remember the names. But at that time, I'd had enough con law, just acres of it, and so the questions were required two answers, and I didn't have complete confidence that whoever corrected them would have other than a crib sheet that matched the old question. So that's why I had to take so much time writing. But anyway, it wasn't an exam. When I came up, the bar exam was perhaps like given in the fall of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to work for Judge Fogle, and there was a tremendous backlog of cases and motions and stuff. Worked day and night, literally. Worked Sundays. Every night.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Fitzgerald was in the prosecuting attorney's office at that time. And if you talk to him, or if you talk to him, I think you'll find that... that was the accepted thing. He was working nights also, and we often used to run into each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember getting up from Christmas dinner and going back down to the office. But anyway, we were very busy. And I can remember the judge said I could take a month off to prepare for the bar exam. But they were behind up here in Anchorage, so we made a trip up to Anchorage, and the judge sat up here, and then he went back down to Ketchikan, and we made a little trip, side trip on out, tried a case in Dillingham.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the day before the exam, I was still in Ketchikan. I hadn't had a chance to do any review.
Uh-huh.
yet. So that it was kind of fresh. I had read all of the Alaska statutes before I came up. There were only, you know, 3 volumes and some supplements, and I had read the Alaska statutes at the Cornell Law Library, and I'd also read the 1913 compilation, and I'd looked at the 1933 compilation. 1913 is the best of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly was better than the 1949 compilation. But anyway, I had a general idea of what the statutory law was because I'd read them all. And I was in Ketchikan, and the weather was terrible. And the commercial lines weren't flying. So I wasn't going to be able to get back to Juneau to take the bar. And Clarence Rhodes, who was then head of the Federal Fish and Wildlife, was coming up to Juneau. And Judge Folda knew him and heard about that he was going to fly up. They had their own, you know, I think he had a widgeon. I'm sure it was a widgeon, or maybe it was a goose, probably a widgeon, pretty sure it was a widgeon. Anyway, he was going to fly up, and so the judge asked him if I could ride up with him, and that's how I got to Juneau in the late afternoon of the day before the bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
But I know the weather was so bad. We went down to get in the plane, and the seagulls were all, you know, standing on top of the pile, and they weren't flying either. We taxied quite a ways in that widgeon in order to get to where we could get a little patch of visibility to take off. And then we took off. Of course, Clarence had made the trip many times, so he was familiar with the terrain. That's a long trip to remember, and I know we were flying right along, right tight on the water, and I was kidding him when I told him if I'd known this was the way we were going to come, I'd have brought a fish pole so I could troll. But and he was very casual about it. And I remember looking out the window sideways, see, we fly right along over the water, maybe 15, 20 feet off the water, and you look sideways at the shoreline. You don't have enough visibility to see ahead. You look sideways. And he maintains a distance off the shoreline. It's a simple way. You keep doing that, sooner or later you're going to find anchorage, if nothing happens in between.
So you're on your anchorage? Or
Juneau.
Juneau,
excuse me.
Yeah.
Yep, so Juneau, if he. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we were flying along and I saw, you know, a dead tree, a snag that had tipped over on the beach. It had a kind of particular shape to it. And 15, 20 minutes later, I saw another one look just like it, and which I thought was very unusual. And so that alerted me a little bit, and I kept close watch, and pretty soon, by golly, you know, I saw a third one.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned that to Clarence, and the weather was not good, you see, and we'd been flying along, maintaining a distance off the shoreline, and through a little patch of fog, we drifted out on an island, and we were flying around and around and around an island. So that startled him, and we went up on top, and then of course we got above the cloud cover, and we couldn't get back down. They had a lot of difficulty.
Yeah.
We finally, they went around, we keep trying holes. They found a hole that let us down near the end of Gastineau Channel, where you could see to get on in, but...
By then, the bar exam would be nothing.
Oh, I was sleeping. There wasn't anything I could do. Clarence later bought it up in the north.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they named the reserve area up there for him. It's a good pond. Can't push with.
Did J. Gerald Williams get the exam? Was he the one who?
I think the Attorney General's office was responsible for the exam at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recollect, when you say, did he give the exam, I don't recollect anyone whatsoever being in the exam room, and I guess the exam was probably given in the old federal building in Juneau. But I would have been pretty well focused on the exam. I wouldn't. If he was there, I just don't remember him, and I can't imagine him being there because it would be noisy if he was, and you usually would remember it, you know.
What was his reputation in Juneau?
Noisy. Yeah.
Had you run into him a lot?
You know, everybody knew Jerry. Mm-hmm. Jerry was a kind of an institution even at that time. Mm-hmm. And was always a lot of fun. He'd come around, he'd say, "No, I promised my wife I wouldn't get in any more fights." But he was over to Douglas, over to Mike's steakhouse or something, and somebody said something. Jerry said he knew that he'd had too much to drink. He couldn't get in a fight with him. So he got a bottle of Tabasco sauce and drank that to sober up. Then he went and got in a fight. But anyway, Jerry was, he was an institution. Mm-hmm. And it always has been a lot of fun.
Did you go right up to Anchorage after your clerkship?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was in Anchorage. Judge Folda spent a fair amount of time in Anchorage during the time that I worked for him because the calendar was further behind up here. Mm-hmm. And I was in Anchorage at the time I terminated. Mm-hmm. And all I did was just, Ray Plummer had an office over in the 220 Central Building. I just walked across the street and went to work there.
Did you know Judge Diamond?
Yes.
What was he like?
Oh, he's a marvelous old gentleman. Mm-hmm. You know. And I'm sure others know much more about him than I.